importance of being earnest.
Welcome to the Criterion Quest, a continuing podcast series looking at important classics and contemporary films. My name is Chris, and I'm joined, as always, by my wonderful co-host, Tom.
Hello.
And we just finished watching Anthony Asquith's 1952 film, The Importance of Being Earnest.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Highly British film.
I dare I say the most British film I've seen in a long time.
All right, well, we should do a synopsis.
Yeah. It's obviously an adaptation of the classic Oscar Wilde play, which is just a farcical comedy about, the easy logline for it would be two women find themselves both engaged to a man that doesn't exist. Mm. So it's, basically these two men, John, aka, Jack and Algernon, who, God damn it. So Jack is a man who has lived in the country, but basically comes down to town and has created a kind of dual personality where he's Jack in the country and Ernest once he's in town. And through those proceedings, he's fallen in love with, and she has fallen in love with him, Algernon's cousin. And basically, that's where the plant... God, this is a really fucking... convoluted plot to try and explain.
I'm so glad you're doing the synopsis.
No, yeah, I thought it'd be so, super easy. Jack as Ernest has fallen in love with Algernon's cousin, and basically through all of the happenstance that happens usually with a farce or a satire, Algernon finds out that he's not actually called Ernest, his name is Jack, and hijinks ensue in which Jack, Algernon goes to Jack's country house, having found out that he has a young ward named Cecily, who he then falls in love with while pretending to be named Ernest, the imaginary man, and hijinks ensue. Very British hijinks.
Well done.
I guess. Yeah, I really should, we'll just put it as, two women find themselves engaged to the... a man that doesn't exist, like this fictional Ernest.
Yeah, it's a convoluted plot.
Yeah,
but that's which the works. Point. That's the fun of it, and
yeah, that's what makes it so farcical. Is just it keeps compounding and like building upon itself, and just it, like kind of spiraling inward into wonderful implosion of British high society hijinks.
Mm.
Yeah. It should be said, like, when the film, and, like, obviously it's based off of the classic Oscar Wilde play, and so the film opens with a man and a woman kind of sitting down in opera seats in boxes at the theatre, opening up a programme that says The Importance of Being Earnest, and then we're presented with a stage, and both you and I were let out audible, ah, fuck.
Yeah, yeah.
I was dreading another Magic Flute scenario where we were just going to watch a filmed version of a play. Thankfully, that was not the case.
Yeah, this is how you would project a play on film in the best way.
Yeah.
Because, as you say, that Magic Flute, where it's just put a camera in front of a stage, is so fucking stupid and bad that it makes the film a non-film.
It's widely considered to be one of the best adaptations of Oscar Wilde's work, and this is the perfect example of taking a play and putting it into a new medium, this being film. But I think having that whole kind of opening sequence is just paying homage and like pointing out that this has its roots in theatre, and that's what they're doing by that. And it thankfully does, like, it immediately shifts from we're watching a play into full proper produced film, which is lovely.
Yeah.
Because I could not deal otherwise.
Yeah, no, I echo that sentiment.
Although, that being said, we, for the first minute or two, we were very kind of worried. Like, this, once the film kind of got going, we realised how very British it was. And there was, I think, some concerns of like, oh god, is this actually going to be entertaining? Is this going to be fun? What kind of type of film is this actually going to be? But it within about 10 minutes, that's all gone, and you just get swept up in the bizarreness and fun storytelling that it was.
Yeah, the first 5 minutes was fucking boring.
It really was.
Really boring.
I think it's the problem of it's... We keep saying it's so British. Like, imagine, our dear listeners, imagine the most British thing ever. Crank that up to 11, and that is the importance of being earnest. It is so British. And we're saying this as Australians. Like, you know, it's very, very British, and it's so dry that it's kind of takes you a little bit, to adjust to what you're seeing. And what you're hearing and everything with the thick and fast dialogue. I think that's the other problem is...
Well, I was not aware of the importance of being earnest at all. Mm. I mean, I'd heard of it, but I'd never watched a play, I'd never read the book. I've read a couple of books in my time.
Yeah.
And I never watched any of the other editions that, you know, have been put to film.
I remember seeing the 2002 film that has, I think, Rupert Everett in it. But that's, God, like, saw that when it first came out, so, you know.
How many adaptations are there?
There's the two major theatrical ones, which are this and the 2002 version. But there's been, like, multiple TV movies, miniseries, like, all of... It's been adapted constantly, and it's become one of those classic pieces of theatre that is constantly... in rotation somewhere. Mm. Like, it's just a wonderful piece of theatre, so keeps getting done.
Well, the thing is, I think as a film, it's not that great, the technical aspects of it.
Yeah.
I mean, the costumes are fun, but I would assume that that's kind of easy to do because it's set in the late 19th century.
You're talking strictly cinematography, lighting,
yeah.
Editing.
Yeah. As a film.
Yeah.
It's not... I think... wasn't coming across any massive wow factors, you know? There's a kind of some cool cuts here and there, but basically I found that the story itself, the acting, was the main draw card.
Yeah. Yeah, the acting and the dialogue is what hooks you in and gets you genuinely invested and caring and interested in the film.
I fucking loved it.
Yeah. Like, it honestly was a thing where... It hit about the 10-minute mark, and there was a line of dialogue that had us both, like, burst out laughing. And from then, it was like, we were continually laughing throughout the film.
I think it was the old lady. What's her name?
Oh, shit.
I remember most of the names, but I just don't remember. Probably the best performance of the whole film.
Yes, without a doubt. Lady Blacknell, played by Edith Evans.
Gwendolyn's mother.
Yes. Algernon's aunt.
Algernon.
Algernon, sorry. I kept getting it mistaken for Krieger from Archer.
she does an amazing job. And she mentions cucumber sandwiches. We've got to get this line up. It's just... made me fall in love with the film.
Cucumber sandwiches? Why such reckless extravagance in one serving?
It wasn't Lady Blacknell who said the line. It was Jack that said it. So that cue. That's what makes Oscar Wilde so much fun. Is the ridiculous nature of his dialogue. And once you kind of can, you find a hook line like that that gets you into it, and then you just keep finding these wonderful fucking gems constantly throughout, and you can't help but fall in love with the piece.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Right, so, how are we going to break this film down?
I am not too sure.
Because there's many scenes which work really well in there. Funny, there's scenes where, I guess like the whole... idea that you're going to have two friends in high society that have a kind of dark streak.
I debate dark streak.
Well, they're relative to high society.
Yeah, I suppose.
Do you know
what
I mean? Like, they're not dicks. They're not bad people. But in context,
yeah,
inside in high society, to pretend and lie and make these stories is terribly bad.
Yes.
You know, to us it's like, you know, whatever, I don't give a fuck. These guys are trapped in high society, it seems.
Yeah.
Trapped in high society, they need to put forward this image of some kind of perfection. And to do what they really want, they need to invent these alter egos.
Yes.
And so everyone understands that there's Ernest, who is really Jack. And Jack really wants to do whatever he wants to do in the, at his, you know, countryside.
Yeah.
But in the city, he's, you know,
he has to be
Ernest.
Yes. Which, obviously, there's no, like, very little point in pointing out the double entendre and the wordplay there of Ernest. So,
yeah. And Algernon's the same. He likes to...
But contrasted, like, in the city, he's Algernon, and in the country, he finds himself being able to... He just instantly slides into being Ernest. This getting a chance of...
Yeah, sounds like the city is fucking balls. Everyone wants to get out into the countryside.
I don't know, though. Algernon seems like a pretty... He doesn't actually... That's what's interesting. Neither character seems to adjust their personality based on location. It just seems like...
They just want an out.
Yeah.
They just want some kind of way to...
And
as they say, they're searching for pleasure as their main drive.
Yeah.
And it seems like
it's just the idea of busting out of what is prescribed to them because of the culture and the society in which they live in.
Mm.
And by assuming these kind of pseudonyms and alternate personalities, they're able to do that and be someone different.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
I reckon the way we're going to talk about this film is... it's going to be basically driven by characters and the story itself.
Yep.
I feel like we're not really going to be able to tackle the stuff that I usually want to talk about, which is how you make a good film.
Yeah, because it's not necessarily a good film. It's just a very competently made and constructed film. But like you mentioned earlier, what makes it stand out is the performances in the script.
But that's just the novel, though. Or the play, really.
Yeah.
So it seems like it's from what I've read, that it's pretty hardcore in its adaptation. It wants to stay very, very true.
Yes, that was to the point of no one is credited with a screenplay credit. It just is Oscar Wilde's Importance of Being Earnest.
Okay.
Anthony Asquith himself did adapt the play to a screenplay, but he doesn't give himself credit for it because he's like, no, it is... It's Oscar Wilde. Like, that's his words and everything.
So it seems like he didn't change it.
No, not at all. It was very minimal, I think. The odd line of dialogue, or possibly the odd changing of setting, but that was it.
Yeah.
To kind of help speed it along to a, you know, brisk 140 or whatever it was.
It's like an hour and 31 minutes.
Yeah. Mm. Crisp 90 or whatever. Yeah.
131 minutes.
No, it didn't go for 2 hours 10. That's insane.
Sorry, an hour 31.
Yeah, I always fuck that up as well.
Anyway, but can I just want to like gush over sequences, but I don't really want to do that as well.
No, because that'll just end up being this was cool and this was cool and this was cool. Okay, which character was it that you found yourself kind of connecting with the most, I should say?
No. Connecting with or getting the biggest kick out of?
Yes, that's what I meant to say. Like, which character do you find the most enjoyable out of? We'll say this, the five leads, the five mains.
Actually, I found the men in the cast to be adequate but not amazing.
Yeah.
That's
what's interesting about it is they're obviously the leads because it's, you know, the play I think was written in 1893.
It's like they're driving the story.
Yeah. And it's also, you know, it was the late 1800s. Like, you don't have a woman be a leader, but like, yeah. In particular, in high society. No.
That's the time when you can marry your cousin.
Yes. So they're the protagonists, for lack of a better word, because they are the impetus for driving the story. But neither of them is particularly interesting. It's in the minor characters of the three women that are the most interesting and well-rounded characters and actually connect, I guess, and drive what is going.
Well, it's their reactions that are the most intriguing.
Yeah.
And I thought that all of the ladies were were marvelous. They were they were so good.
You swooned a little.
Well, yeah, I mean, especially Cecile.
Cecilia?
Or Cecilia? Cecile?
Cecil. What?
Cecil's a guy's name.
I know. Cecily.
Cecily, okay.
Yeah.
So I thought she was absolutely incredible. Mm. I loved that you have a character that is also, you know, obviously everyone's in the high society thing, and I loved that she is drawn to some kind of, not evil nature, but she wants out of a man someone that's, you know, intelligent and proper, but has a wonderfully crooked side to them as well.
Which seems to be in contrast to what her mother is expecting, which is kind of laid out in that wonderful scene where she, Lady Blacknell is kind of grilling Jack as to, you know, if he's appropriate to be, you know, a future son-in-law, and all the kind of points she's trying to hit on seems to be the stuff that he's actually counter to, but he's kind of bullshitting and, you know, feeding her what she wants to hear. And it's the fact that he counters seems to be all the points of why Cecily is attracted to him and kind of connects with him. So she as well, like you're saying, is one of those... This is a film, like, wanting... full of characters wanting to break out of the society and the place that they're put into.
Mm.
Yeah.
I know, that's his, like, major strength. I think that's just the point.
And do you think, like... Obviously, that's the point of what it's doing, but... Is that... God, what was I going to fucking say? So the characters themselves are wanting to break out of high society... Not necessarily break out of high society, but rebel against it. Do you think that that's what the film... The story itself is doing by kind of presenting these characters as kind of heightened kind of caricatures... It itself is skewering high society and kind of pointing out the ridiculousness of that.
Yeah, I think it is trying to say that there's a rigidity in this society, and I think that the mother is kind of, she does not move and she's fucking in her place and she knows her place and she is trying to make everybody adhere to the old ways.
Well, she's talking about how education is bad and ignorance is great.
Ignorance is like a beautiful flower?
Yeah.
That's so fucking funny.
Yeah.
but all of the younger generation are naturally breaking away from that in their own little way.
Yeah.
As best as they can. And I guess like the happy ending is that everyone can... It's kind of a... Like, it's a happy ending, obviously. Everybody, you know, gets together and stuff. And even the mother is happy.
Yeah,
Only by way of... like, almost like a logic drop that...
Yeah.
Fuck. This is a hard one to fucking talk about, man.
It kind of is, right?
Yeah, no, I got nothing, actually.
No, fucking... well, like, you were kind of saying, like, everyone kind of ends happily and, you know... I think that is my one problem with the film, is everything ends up wrapped up into a nice little package.
even to the point where like Jack's real name is Ernest anyway.
Yeah, and he gets to find out who his parents were, and it's like, literally every fucking thing is tied up perfectly. I guess you could argue that that's really wonderfully done, in the sense that every single thing that has been set up pays off in the end. But at the same time, it pays off in such a cliche, shitty way.
Yeah, I think that's...
Especially, like, I think I have a problem with it because Cecily herself points out earlier that... Because she's a voracious reader, and she points out that she doesn't like books that have happy endings.
Mm.
So that kind of helps plant, at least in me as a viewer, plants the idea of, oh, not everyone is going to end up happy at the end of this. And then when that's the case, you're kind of like, that...
But who's unhappy, man? Like, literally everybody gets their way.
Exactly, that's what I mean. Like, I'm saying I was expecting somebody to not have a happy ending, but literally every single person including the crazy lady Mrs. Prism, she gets her bag back. Everything works out fine.
She didn't have her bag for so long, and she never bought another one. So.
Like, literally everything works out for everyone, and it's all wrapped up within the last 5 minutes of the film, which is a little bit...
Yeah, but it still works within that situation where they... where... What's her name? Miss Prism.
Yeah.
She says... In true fiction, there is all the bad people get a bad ending and all the good people get a good ending. There's no bad people in this story.
That's true.
So naturally, everyone would have a good ending.
That's true, yeah.
Even the mother's kind of...
She's not bad. She's not malicious in her intent. She's just ignorant. So...
Yeah, I can't really hold that against her. Like, she's...
And I suppose as well, like, the ridiculous nature of the ending where... everything comes to a head, and it just is like, resolution, 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 resolution. Like, just all of these things being thrown out within, like, a five-minute dialogue sequence. It lends itself to such a theatrical nature that you kind of can't fault it.
This is what I think about that. Douglas Adams, he likes to put plot points in that start, like, a line of story as... a coincidence, something coincidental happens, which drives the plot.
Yes.
And it's always fun and stuff like that. But he also, so I remember him reading some article fucking ages ago, and I hope I'm correct, because I don't want to put words in his mouth, but he said that you can drive a plot with coincidence, but you can't wrap up a plot with coincidence, because it doesn't feel good.
No.
So the fact that Jack's real name is Ernest anyway is a coincidence.
Yeah.
And it wraps up that little... plot hole that could have turned out poorly. It doesn't really feel satisfying, because it's like, his name's Ernest already. Okay, how lucky is he? And it's just like, no one worked for that. It just fell into place.
Yeah.
So it always feels like, kind of breaks the immersion, where you go like, it's almost like the writer is like too lazy to think up of a really good explanation to close that little loop.
Yeah, and the fact that Mrs. Prism, who was, you know, the caretaker of his war, like, it's all of these lines being drawn to, like, that all come together. It's so coincidental that you're just like, all right, I guess.
Yeah, I'm not to say that Oscar Wilde is a very bad writer.
Yeah, let's shit on Oscar Wilde for a little while.
Yeah, no, I don't want to say that. But
he's a literary giant. Like, he's fucking incredible. And, like, this is proof of that. Like, this has some of the driest, wittiest humour I've seen in, like, such a very long time. Like, I love some of the word... like, the wordplay in this is what... This kind of shit gets me going. I love it.
Yeah.
So...
I think, like, the pinnacle of the film is the sequence where the two girls meet at the country house. And they're divulging their plans to get married to this Ernest. And they obviously, even though he's fictitious...
not only is he fictitious, but they're in their minds, they're talking about two different people at the same time.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
So, like, that whole sequence is completely marvelous. And so, yeah, even though there is this stupid coincidental closed loop with the, you know, his name's Ernest anyway, it's got such a fucking strong story everywhere else, where it's just like, it doesn't even matter if the film is only adequately put together.
Yeah.
The acting and the dialogue and the story itself is so fucking strong.
The sum of its parts, like, equal it to a great thing. Like, it doesn't matter. Yeah.
Like, I would almost want to watch the other adaptations.
It's okay. It's a lot more, from what I remember, and this is seeing it 15 years ago when it first came out, it's trying to be more of a kind of Richard Curtis-y kind of Richard Curtis meets he did Four Weddings and a Funeral, Love Actually, that kind of stuff, meets a Merchant Ivory film, so like Sense and Sensibility, like, well, that was Ang Lee, but that like, it's trying to be a Richard Curtis period piece. Like, it's leaning on the absurdity, and it's trying to be so light and fluffy that it's fine. Like, I mean, I'm shitting on a film I haven't seen in 15 years.
Yeah.
And I saw it once, but, I remember it being like, yeah, that was fine. But it didn't... the impact of the dialogue and the wordplay didn't hit me nearly as much, obviously, because I can barely fucking remember it, as did with this adaptation.
Is that because of the actors doing what they're doing, or
I think it's the film itself. By virtue of the fact that the film is literally presenting the play, pretty much. Like, because of the lack of flair and cinematic style behind it, you're forced to you as the audience are forced to connect with and dial in on the characters and the dialogue. That's what you hone in and try and focus on, because there's not much else going on. You're just being presented this in very flat imagery.
Mm.
And as such, you get hooked. You don't get hooked by it being a good film, you get hooked by it being an amazing script.
But it still could do with, I don't know, like,
It did have its moments of cinematic flourish, like when Jack proposes to Gwendolyn, like, there is the camera pushes in on him and stuff. Like, there are those little odd flourishes, but I think, for the most part, it is a very flat, simple film.
I think you could do so much more with it. Take the handbag that's in this glass enclosure. It's always just there, whereas, like, that's a kind of an interesting artifact that's intrinsically part of the story, right? You could do so much with shooting that in a certain way, cutting to it in a certain way, whatever. I'm not gonna, like, say that I know what I'm doing in terms of filmmaking, but it would seem to be that you could certainly start to put imagery in the film. Still, don't change the script, don't change the characters, don't change the actors,
but add an extra level of visual storytelling.
Exactly, like a little bit of symbolism, or, you know, this, that, and whatever would just aid it and make it turn it from a let's put a camera in front and tell the story of this play through the lens of a camera into an actual, like, how can we better tell this story film?
Take this story from another medium and translate it into a filmic medium and enhance it for that medium, not necessarily elevate an already great material, but reinterpret.
Because the funny thing is it sounds like I am saying you could put a camera in front of a stage and that's this movie.
Mm.
And we've already said at the start of this podcast that's
shitty. That's not the case.
Yeah, it's shitty and that's not what is happening, but really it's like it feels like we've swapped a stage with its fake locations to real locations and that's it.
Yeah.
In this film. It's still, I mean, the fact is it's an awesome movie. Despite the kind of non-film technique stuff.
Yeah. I think that is a testament to performances in the script. Like, I keep going back to that as being the thing that made me connect with it. And I think, yeah, you're right. It's a good film, despite the fact that, like,
This film is bullshit to talk about.
Yeah.
It's, you know, like, what else is there to say?
More or less, yeah. We're kind of,
You know, we could kind of talk about, the strange fact that everyone's okay with, Jack, now Ernest, marrying his cousin.
Yeah.
And everyone's like, fuck yeah.
Way to go, buddy.
Hey, you're actually from, a good family. It just so happens that it's your, that family is also your fiancé's
It's also
family.
Our family, yeah. So welcome to the family you are already a part of and,
you know,
marrying your cousin.
Welcome to the family again.
Like, what is this, right? Shelbyville?
Yeah, that was,
that was,
know,
the
that doesn't age well then.
That was my problem, like, when the big reveal comes of Jack actually, like, finding out his origins of who he was and, like, finding out his real name and who his parents were. You're supposed to be like, oh, wow, wonderful! But I just was sitting there
there's
like,
some red flags going on.
Yeah, that's what happens. And there's so much, like, uh-oh.
Yeah, I'm like, oh, this sucks.
Now we can't marry the woman he loves.
Now the story's fucked.
And then you're like, oh, wait, it's the 1800s. Nothing's fucked.
Except for the cousin.
Except for Gwendolyn. I feel we'd be remiss if we didn't spend a good portion of our time discussing Lady Black Milk. Like, she... Her performance... Like, I think as a character, she... It's very well written and thing. It's very well written, and it's a very... It's the meaty character. It's the villain, for lack of a better term, of the piece. Like, she's the...
She's like some kind of resistance. For
yeah, exactly. But it's Edith Evans's performance in that role that is so fucking hardcore that makes it transcend to something wonderful. If you haven't seen the film, I'm hoping if you're familiar with Hedonism Bot from Futurama, I am dead certain that Edith Evans's performance in this film was Maurice LaMarche's, the voice actor's, inspiration for that character.
Yeah, it's so similar.
You commented at one point, what, she managed to take a single syllable...
Oh, she said the word found, but she managed to put five syllables into it.
She managed to stretch out the word found into a five-syllable word. It is a fucking masterclass performance of... Like, nothing of that is... It's just like, I found this. And she's like, I found this. Why did you think to do that? That's amazing. That's it's phenomenal, her performance.
Yeah.
I actually found a really wonderful quote, actually. Basically, I'm just going to read this little portion. Edith Evans' outraged delivery of the line, a handbag, has become legendary within our English cinema and theatre. As actor Ian McKellen, now Sir Ian McKellen, has written, it is a performance so acclaimed and strongly remembered that it inhibits audiences and actors years later. So, basically, Ian McKellen's like, no one can do that character other than what she has done. Like, she... Edith Evans's performance and what she created with Lady Blacknell is so synonymous with that character now that if you do that part, you have to do that. Like, there's no other way to do that performance.
She was the best.
Than what she created.
She was definitely the best performance in the whole film.
Yeah.
By far. Mm. Yeah, I will remember that.
For
a long time.
Very long time.
She was supposed to be the villain, but she also kind of rides this strange line where it's like, yeah, you're a dick, but somehow it's like...
She's so lovable because she's so over the top.
Yeah.
I'm wondering if that was Edith Evans being like, this character isn't evil in her mind. She's just...
Well, she's only looking out for her daughter.
Yeah.
You know? Like,
you said, she's combative. She's not evil. She's not malicious. She's just... You know, she is the combative force that causes the narrative to happen. So
I think we're kind of used to jumping into films like this and expecting
a mustache twirler or something.
Yeah,
like
exactly.
That. Yeah.
Exactly. Like, you're going to want to have the Cruella de Vil kind of
exactly.
character.
Yeah.
So naturally, you're going to be trying to stack on this. Oh, you must be the bad character, the evil villain. When really, like, nobody is. And,
no.
It's actually a really lovely film like that.
Yeah. They're just like, everyone gets what they wanted and everything works out fine.
Yeah.
And we get some witty wordplay.
And you still have conflict.
Yeah.
It's still like very dramatic.
It's pretty lovely.
Yeah, it's a really good movie.
Hmm. I'm wondering if we're kind of gushing over it because it's been so long since we've had a film like this. Because prior to Tenenbaums, we'd had just such a long string of documentaries and... It's been a while since we've sunk our teeth into an actual film, it seems.
No.
No?
No.
It's just, no, like, I'm just, you know.
No, I don't think...
I'm not saying that to detract from the actual film itself, but...
I think that you are, man.
Nah.
No, I think, well, we watched Tenenbaums last time, so it's and, you know, we've obviously been watching other films.
Yeah,
I've
so
been watching Harry Potter for...
Like, nice. What are you up to?
I'm up to the I'm up to the last one now. I've been binging it.
Do they hold up, the later ones? Because I remember seeing them at the movies and being like, "Oh, these are great." And
I actually stopped watching Harry Potter for the cinematic experience after the Half-Blood Prince.
Mm.
I kind of got bored. It was actually the part one of the
Deathly Hallows.
Deathly Hallows. And I was like, they're just camping.
They're keeping the balls up in the air. Yeah.
Yeah. And so I actually never saw the ending. And then Cole got me to rewatch them. She loves them. And they're fucking awesome.
You agree, like everyone, that the third one is the best, right?
Yeah, I do.
Yeah.
and in terms of books too, the third one's always my favourite.
Mm.
Fucking just like that time travel shit. It's just
plus Alfonso
so good.
Alfonso Cuarón is the director. Come on.
Yeah, it's really good.
Gary Oldman. Ugh.
Anyway, so my point is though, we're talking about Harry Potter. I'll happily talk about Harry Potter, but my point is that I've been watching heaps of cool films in between all these rather dry experiences that we've been having of late.
Yeah.
This film. It's fucking
awesome. It's super lovely. It's we've had a few films that I've been trying to think of a way to describe them. They're like kind of between like the late 30s and early 50s. That kind of era of filmmaking. It's not quite getting into the realm of the Preston Sturges stuff, like Sullivan's Travel or The Lady Eve. Not getting into that realm, but it's the stuff like My Man Godfrey. Like if you remember that one about. The homeless guy. It's those type of films. We've had to encounter a fair amount of them, and very few have kind of, I think, will stick with me. This is one I think is definitely going to linger, just because it's so memorable because of the heightened performances and the heightened dialogue, and it's just fun. And
I'm going to be quoting that cucumber sandwich bullshit. for a long time.
And what was the other one you said you were going to start incorporating? It's like, do you smoke? Well, yes, I do. Well, good.
Man's got to have an occupation.
Yeah. Wonderful shit like that.
Fuck yeah.
Yeah. But I guess unless you got anything else, we can move on to trivia itself.
Okay.
So the film was nominated for a BAFTA for Most Promising Newcomer to Film, and that was Dorothy Tootin. Or Tutton, however you want to pronounce it, who played Cecily.
Yeah, she was great.
Yeah, she was nominated for a BAFTA. The film was also nominated for the Golden Lion at the 1952 Venice Film Festival, but it did win at that festival the Best Production and Design, which is the International Award. So, yeah, well, I'll rephrase that. It won the International Award for Best Production Design. Like, that's the thing you can't fault. The costumes and the production of everything.
So is that like an umbrella term for you just did a really good job?
Set direction
at general
and set dressing.
Design.
Yeah, design of the... Like, production design is usually sets, not necessarily costume or wardrobe. It's more the locations themselves and how they're presented.
Yeah.
Is production design.
Okay.
At least in a modern setting, at least.
Well, Algernon's suit was great. It was
a
great
and
suit.
Not... Fuck off, Lady Blackmore's butterfly hat.
Yeah, that was great.
That was incredible. In keeping with the film's theatrical origins, Anthony Asquith shot it mostly in sequence and used long takes to let the actors develop the rhythm of Oscar Wilde's dialogue. Director Anthony Asquith was the son of H.H. Asquith, who, as home security, brought the charges of immorality which led to Oscar Wilde's imprisonment.
What?
Yeah,
I didn't know about that. What?
That's a lot to get into.
Sorry.
I just recommend watch the biopic Wild about Oscar Wilde starring Stephen Fry. It's fucking phenomenal. But yeah, Oscar Wilde was imprisoned for immorality and stuff with his writings, and yeah. So basically,
Anthony, so he was. They tried to censor him, effectively.
Yes. Okay. And it turns out the Anthony Asquith, who directed this film, was the son of one of the people who helped that process.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's cool.
Yeah.
Oh, shit.
That would be an interesting story.
Mm.
But, yeah, I tried digging a little deeper to find some more info on that, and other than... just the whole blanket info of, like, by that I mean like the relationship between Asquith and Wilde, but there was very little as a pope. Like, there's a lot about Oscar Wilde being imprisoned for immorality. There's, you know, like I said, see the biopic and heaps
to
read
up. What kind of court case is that? You know, you're immoral, therefore you need to be imprisoned.
That used to happen with artists all the fucking time.
And I suppose it's, 19th century.
Yeah, or 18th century, like, the late 1800s, so, yeah.
That's 19th century.
Oh, yeah, Derek.
I do that all the time
as well.
There should be a rule where you're not allowed to say the nth century.
Yeah.
It always has to be the 1800s.
That's why I always say 1800s. Yeah. Just so it's like, it's no room for confusion. Yeah. Like we just had.
I agree.
So John Gielgud was actually offered the role of Jack Worthing in the film. Even though it was one of his signature roles on stage, he turned it down because he disliked filming. Which I find kind of interesting.
That's fine.
I like John Gielgud.
I find it funny
because I know him from so many films, like that he would then go on to become such a film star, and you know.
So he was okay. Oh, so I thought that he was just like super eccentric.
No. I want to say he won an Academy Award. He definitely won an Academy Award. I'm gonna look up now.
So was he like a late bloomer? He does the theater circuit and he loves it. And then for a long time he's like, "There's nothing like theater. We can't fucking do it in film. I ain't gonna do takes."
I'd imagine maybe something like that, or more to the extent of like, no, you do. Films are films. This is theater. Like you don't adapt, like you know, do an adaptation of that to you know the play that lives and breathes in what it was, and you don't turn it into a film.
So purist.
Yeah,
that's okay.
I was right in my mind. He won the Academy Award for Best Supporting Actor for Arthur, the Dudley Moore, Liza Minnelli comedy. He played Arthur's butler.
I don't know what that is.
You don't know Arthur?
No, I don't know what that is.
You should watch Arthur. Arthur is great.
What's that?
I'll tell you later. I'll show you the trailer after we're done.
Okay.
Edith Evans had problems adjusting to film acting, particularly when it came to hitting her marks on the floor. She told Anthony Asquith, "I always feel the camera should come to me instead of me going to the camera."
What? Fucking...
That's Lady Blackall at her best.
That's super cool.
Those are kind of the main ones. So the rest of the stuff is kind of more trivial trivia. Like, this was Anthony Asquith's first film to be done in colour. We've only done one other of his films so far, and we did Pygmalion.
Oh yeah, that was quite good.
And the other one that I thought was kind of fun is the on-screen credits are done in order of appearance, not in order of importance. I thought the wording of that was fun.
That's very trivial.
Yes.
by the way, why it had an Act 1 card?
Yes.
At the start, and then
I think that's
no...
just keeping in tone with the theatrical elements of it.
Yeah, but why put Act 1 when there's no other... I mean, there were acts, if you want to call them acts, but there was only one instance of bring up a title card.
Happened right after we were introduced to the cast, as if the man or woman up in the theatre box was reading through the programme.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Okay, yes.
So that's why
that makes a little bit of sense.
Yeah. So we'll move on to the actual Criterion edition itself. The film is still in print as the film is still available as a one disc DVD. It's also available on to rent through iTunes. But if you get the physical release, it comes with a new digital transfer, rare production stills, and the theatrical trailer, as well as the usual booklet and essays that Criterion always do. I was not expecting a whole bunch of stuff for this one. It's hard to expect the, like, you know, riveting special features for this.
Yeah, 1952 film.
Yeah. But I guess, unless you've got anything else, that'll probably wrap us up for this week's episode. If you have any comments or queries or think we've missed anything, please send us an email at thecriterionquest@gmail.com or feel free to follow us on Twitter @CriterionQuest or find us on Facebook @TheCriterionQuest.
This episode especially, because I feel like we haven't explored it. Usually I would try and, you know, pin down something here.
Yeah.
And we have to a large degree, but to some degree.
You'd be intrigued to see other people's impressions of...
Yeah, I feel like that we've missed stuff here.
Yeah.
Because it's been a difficult one to grasp.
It's one, I think if we were given time, other than, you know, watching the film and then jumping straight into recording, we could probably explore a little bit more, but I don't know. Yeah, if you have any, you know, theories or what, we'd be interested to hear your take on this.
Yeah.
Yeah. But other than that, we will be back in a fortnight's time with another Kurosawa.
Yes.
Yeah, we are, when we explore Redbeard, one of the few Kurosawas I've never seen. So I'm very excited for this.
Rad.
Yeah. But for this week's episode, I'm Chris.
I'm Tom. See you next time.